The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Let me answer the second one first. Is it possible to live a sin-free life? No. How was that? I don't think that's possible. If the question has to do with, is it possible to live a life free of addiction? I think that the answer to that is probably yes. But I don't think that here on God's earth we're going to be able to do that. If you do figure out how to do that, though, my address is in the bulletin. I would appreciate any calls on that. But no, I don't believe that's possible. Second question is it ever too late? And I'm assuming, is it ever too late for somebody who's involved in addiction process? I've thought a lot about that. Where do you draw lines with people? How far do you let them go? When is it too late for them? There's a book by Frank Peretti. And in this book, he talks about this town that has made a deal with the devil, basically. And these people go through this... anybody familiar with this book? It's his most recent book, I guess. They make a deal with the devil, and at some points, out of their bodies, they begin to ooze this black stuff from their chests, from their hearts, and this begins to ooze. And they try to hide it, and they cover it up, and through their nice shirts, they ooze this black stuff, and it also begins to smell. And so what they have is they have this smell and this black stuff, and it's a very good picture of what sin and addiction does to people. And late in this illness that occurs with these people, they begin to lose hope, and they begin not to care. They start not hiding it. They begin being giddy about it, and finally they go to this place, which is an old building or something, where the deal with the devil was made, basically. And then this mythical dragon comes and takes them and basically eats them. And I think it's at that point where people begin to lose hope and give up and not to care anymore, that they begin to pass a point where it's very difficult to turn back. Where they know about their addiction, you know about it, and they don't seem to care or care about the consequences of their addiction. And I think that's where people have to draw some boundaries and where it's very difficult. Is anything ever totally hopeless? No, I don't believe that. God has intervened in people's lives in tremendous ways. And he's intervened in my life in tremendous ways. But there are points when people begin not to care. They don't care what happens. They don't care what things they're involved in, where it's very difficult to turn back from. So, any other follow-up questions on that? Sometimes they're not able to verbalize that, but that's... I think it's not just a desire to go in a positive direction, but sometimes people just release themselves totally in the opposite direction, and they don't care in the opposite way. They don't care about their lives. They don't care about what happens. They don't care what happens to other people. And it's at that point where they not only endanger their own lives, but they start to endanger other people and start to ruin other people's lives. And there's times, I guess, when we have to warn them about the consequences of that, knowing that it means a break in the relationship, the friendship. And it talks about that where it talks about where we prevent somebody from something that leads to death. Anyway, we try to turn them back from that. Sometimes it feels hopeless, but you try to go ahead and do that anyway.
The question is, what is a good Christian response when confronted by people gossiping? If I stay and just listen, I become part of it. If I vocalize it's wrong, I become judgmental. I don't know that it's necessary to vocalize that it's wrong. I think it's possible for a person to speak for him or herself and say something like, I don't feel comfortable listening to this because I'm not involved in it, and I'll just you know, wait over here, or I'll tune back in later on, or something like that. If you're not part of the problem or part of the solution, it's gossip, and you can also say that. I don't know how I'm part of the problem or part of the solution, and I don't feel comfortable having this information since I'm not really involved. I don't want to hear this. And I don't know that it's necessary for you to point it out as wrong. It's important for you to speak for yourself and what's going on inside you and your discomfort. And I think that's a way of taking care of it, in a way that's kind of a graceful way as well as speaking the truth. Any follow-up on that? Thank you. No. Any follow-up on that? Thank you.
No fair, I got the two-parter.
Yeah.
One is a practical question about adolescence, and the other is a theological, so I might take you up on your offer, Pastor. The first one says, how do you balance "because I said so" with explaining rules to the nth degree? I think Phil started to allude to this. The "because I said so" mentality is the authoritarian. It's not giving the child a rational explanation, so they don't have any understanding of why it's important to do it. But erring on the other side of explaining to the nth degree does undermine your authority. And so I think you can go back to, you say it once, and then it's like it's from God. That's the way it is, and you back off. And I think that you can get a hint of needing to back off when you find yourself being engaged in a power struggle, when they keep coming back, and you're beginning an argument then. It's no longer you're explaining, now you're defending. The second question says, tips on addressing the issue of prayer. God didn't answer my prayer, or why bother praying when God doesn't give me what I ask for, and I prayed really hard. This is from the perspective of an adolescent. Like I said, teens are at an age where they are asking big questions in life, and some of the big questions have to do with the unexplainable. Why suffering happens, why God doesn't do what we think He should do in the world. And I think the answer is manifold. One is that God sometimes answers our prayers by doing what we want, and sometimes He tells us no. And sometimes there's silence. And sometimes the silence, we're not hearing the answer because we're not listening. And sometimes there is no answer. And so I think this can be a hard one for teenagers, because it's depending on their age. You know, the younger they are, the more things should be black and white. Things should be explainable. Maybe as they're getting a little older, they'll be able to understand that not everything is explainable. But I think it's going to be a hard one for them to grasp. I don't know. Anybody else have a... That was a hard one. Are there any others? Follow-up on that? Well, and the question was, why bother praying when God doesn't give me what I ask for? I mean, that's a very child-centered notion of a relationship, that a relationship is useful to me only so long as the other person is doing what I want them to do. So you're seeing a little bit there of the sort of the narcissistic expectations of the child. And it's actually a teaching opportunity to explain about how relationships work, that people can love one another and be in relationship and not always do what you want them to do, and just then applying that out to God.
You may be the best resource, because probably the best answer is how you answered that question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that is going to be probably the hardest. Yeah, I don't know of a resource in that way. That's a great book, actually. If somebody knows of a book or wants to write a book, that would be real good.
I do think that this brings home the point of needing other people to to speak to issues that maybe the child isn't going to listen to from you. But I also think that you shouldn't undermine your own influence on your child, that you have an opportunity there to share how you handle disappointment, and that you are a resource to them, even though they may not be giving you the impression that he cares to hear your opinion. Self-disclosure, coming from your heart, saying, yeah, I've prayed for things too, and talk about how you handled that, I think is very valuable. But I think also hearing from others is important. Yeah. And I think teaching children the value in prayer is not just that you're rubbing God, the genie, to get out what we want, but that we communicate with God for the same reasons that we communicate with others, and that is to know God and to be known by Him. So to try and help give another perspective on even the reasons for prayer, that it's a way to draw close to God, even when He does things we don't understand or fails to do things that we want.
Yeah. There's something I thought about. What age are we talking about? 14. Okay. Because usually there's the thing that happens, Piaget stuff, with about age, 12, 13, where they begin to think about things more abstractly. And so these kind of issues, this is right sort of in the ballpark of what they're wrestling with. So it'll probably be, I'm not going to say it's going to be something else, but this is the kind of thing that you're going to find in those areas. And interestingly enough, kids before that, when you try to deal with these issues, I don't think they really get it. Like if they're younger and you start talking about reasons why and abstracts and prayer and all that, it goes sort of... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I would want to know why. And maybe that would be the place to start. Okay, you don't want to talk about it, but can you tell me why you don't want to talk about it and see where that leads? Because they're displaying, sort of bad feelings or bad things, or, we need to keep under wraps. So I think I would just start by exploring why that is and see if you get anywhere. And beyond that, I guess just say, well, I need to talk about it maybe, and share what you're thinking about the problem and see. Sometimes you can get children to respond, even they might not initiate the conversation, but if they hear from you, then they might respond to something you're saying.
Anything to add? There are also those teachable moments too, I think, where there are times when you just back off and just like, there are times when I don't want people to ask me questions, and I have the right to say, right now, I just don't want to talk about it. And then at another time, but that is a sort of a sneaky way of doing that. Well, then tell me why don't you want to talk about it? And I found very often that you'll spend the whole time talking about why they didn't want to talk about the thing.
Which is the real issue.
Which is probably the issue, and then that's okay. Yeah.
As a firstborn child, in one hand, I would affirm that, affirm her passion, especially if it's for something constructive. Now, if you see it becoming where she's overly tense, you may want to do relaxing things with her more than instructing her. You need to relax. I mean, that's the worst thing you can tell somebody when they're uptight. Relax. How old is the child? One of the things that I suggest to teenagers is exercise and just blowing off steam that way. It's a good depression buster too. So
it's probably not possible for a church to do everything, and I've known of some churches who do one thing and not another. And some churches who do a couple of things, and some churches that seem to do very little. But I think one of the first things that comes to mind is the area of domestic violence. It's not typical for a church to address that from the pulpit very openly. And often if then there is an example or a case of domestic violence in the congregation, then there's a reluctance to address it because then it seems like that one person is being singled out. So I think there are some areas where the church, if you mean the organization and the pulpit, could address some issues in maybe a preventive way. We are all the church, no matter what building we happen to be in, no matter what setting. And so whatever I say about any given church, I must also examine in myself. I think what comes to mind is the second thing is the ability to come alongside someone and be where they are and just let them be where they are. The scriptures say, rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. And it's very difficult often for us to do that. We want to pull them to a better place, to that, especially if they're mourning, we want to pull them to the rejoicing place. And I think that it seems to be in many circles, I certainly can't speak globally, but it seems to be in many circles a missing element where somebody will just sit and spend time listening to where somebody is for however long it takes. And that's that coming alongside and bearing one another's burdens in a redemptive way that I think is one of the biggest lacks that I see in the church, not meaning the building, but among us as believers.
Oh boy, okay. Well, it seems like the church and psychology are sort of like a bad marriage often. They assume the worst of each other. There's a lack of trust, a lack of understanding. And yet I see people who are not in the church, who are in psychology, who are trying to care for people and are concerned about people. And yet I see, and people in the church are doing the same. And somehow there doesn't seem to be a dialogue between the two. It's interesting, I was a pastor for about 5 years, and I worked as an assistant pastor, and so I've sort of seen that world and been with people talk about those psychologists. And then in my program, serving as in the internship, I've heard a lot of psychologists talking about those religious people. And it seems like there is very little understanding or attempt to integrate the two together. I think it's a shame. And I don't know what steps can be taken in that, but I do think things like this do help. And so in some ways I want to commend you for and commend the church here for bridging a gap which is probably pretty big. We know so much in psychology now about the way the behaviors change, about in educational psychology, there's neurological things, there's pharmacological things and interventions that we know more about every day. And for us in the church to just close our eyes and pretend that that doesn't exist is silly. It also is sort of silly for us to deny the fact that in some ways we have the same terrain that we're on. We're competing in the same and for some of the same terrain. And in America today, psychology is in some ways becoming the religion of the next generation. We have to realize that too. So what's the answer? I'm not sure. But I think things like this and people like yourselves who are educating themselves both in the theological end and in psychology, I think can go a long ways in maybe bridging that gap and bringing some understanding between the two.
Yes, there are. There are a couple. One is the American Association of Christian Counselors, which is a national network. And I know they have a directory that's broken down by region. There's also an organization called CAPS, the Christian Association for Psychological Studies, and they have the same. Focus on the Family has a referral network as well. So there are things out there that if you are looking for a good Christian counselor, you can find them. Yes, Minrith Meyer.
The question is, can a Christian get good services from a non-Christian psychologist? That is my experience. My therapist was a non-Christian, and she respected my Christian faith and didn't mess with it. When she went in that direction, I told her what my belief was, and I think her feeling was that I was healthy in my faith, and she didn't see anything that she would, from her perspective, consider pathological, so she didn't feel obligated to address it. I know that there are some counselors and psychologists out there who think that any religious belief at all is pathological, so, I mean, that's an extreme. But I was helped tremendously in my growth and understanding by somebody who was a non-believer. And you said it, Pastor, the way I would have said it. I would rather have competent services from a non-Christian than incompetent services from a Christian. And so I think it's possible, but I'm not sure how typical it is to be able to get services from a non-Christian if your Christianity is left out of it. Because if that's your core, if that's how you live life, it's kind of leaving a big piece out. And the way I dealt with it was to deal with another person around those issues.
One thing that's always a good indicator is if there are dramatic changes in behavior. A sudden change, a sudden withdrawing from what the child normally would participate in. But one of the signs of adult depression is inability to experience pleasure and things that formerly brought pleasure. And adults can often put that into words. You know, I just don't enjoy anything anymore. Children can't, and so they'll often put that into action. They'll withdraw from things. I think another thing I would look for is if the problems that you're seeing are repetitive and all attempts to solve them are just keeps coming back over and over again and is making pain in your family, then I would seek someone who can help you with that.
I would say also it depends how secretive things are, and also you want to look at other areas of the child's life. How are they functioning in school? How are they functioning? Do they have a part-time job? How do they operate with their friends? How do they do with their peers? So is the problem in one area, or is the problem in several different areas? And obviously, if it's in several different areas, then the scope is a little bit broader. And the area of secretness is there things going on that you don't know about and that you feel uncomfortable? Very often, before you see outward signs of something, you start to get these vibrations, these feelings that there's something wrong. And I think that too many parents don't pay attention to that sense that there is something wrong. We deny that and don't take some kind of action. And usually by the time then when we have evidence of it, the horse is out of the barn already in some way. And so I think that when we get that feeling, we should respond to that in some way. We sort of have a sense of that, I think.